I'm Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Here today, joined by Adam D. Tahani, restaurant designer to the stars. It was great. I was lucky enough to moderate a panel at the CIA's Worlds of Flavor this year with you. And actually, it was fascinating because we didn't talk so much about the grandiose restaurant. We talked about the counter. Omotenashi, is that the correct term? The Japanese idea of that kind of service.
That's correct.
But now we get to talk about the bigger, more elaborate restaurants that you've done in your life. But I want to start in Transylvania, a place most people don't actually think exists. Tell me about your upbringing, your Romanian heritage.
Well, I must say that I you know, have very foggy memories of Transylvania, you know, especially in the evening, on the winter evenings where, you know, the Carpathian Mountains are covered with fog. I was 3 years old when my parents immigrated to Israel. So, but I did go back to visit in Transylvania.
Yeah.
One or two times. And, you know, it's only popular in the United States, I think, you know. When people ask you, where are you from? I said, from Transylvania. They look at you. The first thing said, Pennsylvania. I said, no, Transylvania. Says, ooh, Dracula.
Yeah.
That never happened to me any place on the planet except in the United States. So I really cannot speak much about those early 3 years. It was way, way, way too long ago.
See, I'm thinking of it from more of an architectural standpoint, you know, such Gothic architecture. Then you move to Jerusalem, which has, you know, from golden temples to just sprawling landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
Did you absorb that architecture as a small child?
Well, of course, you cannot take Jerusalem out of your system. I mean, I think the singular most important aspect of privilege of growing up in Jerusalem is the light. You become so enamored with, you know, the magic of light that no matter where you go and what you do after, it's all reflection of that beautiful golden hue of the evenings of Jerusalem. So I must say that, you know, part of my professional formation, or maybe the ability to make people look good, is Jerusalem light.
Yeah. So taking that tint, you went through the Israeli army, and then right after you finished, 2 days later, went off to Milan for school.
That's correct.
What kind of things did you study and see there?
I, if you don't mind, Michael, if I backtrack for a second. I mean, the choice of going to Italy from Israel was sort of a beshert, as we say in my country. I really had no idea what to expect, because I've never been out of Israel before. I grew up in Israel. I lived there most of my life. I went to the army. And the only thing I really wanted to do after the army is get out of Israel. And, you know, 3 years in the Israeli army with a six-day war and so on and so forth can do it to you. Upbringing, background, I just needed space. I needed to breathe and I needed to see the world. And the only schools that were accepting Israeli students at the time, I'm talking about 1969, where you didn't have to pay an arm and a leg. You didn't have to mortgage your life for it, and your parents didn't have to mortgage their life for it. Was in Italy, strangely enough. And the two faculties that were open for Israeli students at the time was veterinary medicine in Bologna and architecture in Milan. And as I always said, you know, the only thing I knew about architecture at the time is that I did not want to be a veterinarian. So this is how I ended up in Italy. And back to the light situation, I landed in Milan in a dreary October day in 1969, and it was totally foggy. We couldn't see a thing. And, you know, coming from Jerusalem light into the dim atmosphere of fog was such an awakening. And I said, oh my God, you know, the rest of the world has to live with this kind of light. It's terrible. I have to fix it.
So, I mean, what did you do to fix it? I know a lot of Italy as not the most, you know, extroverted place, you know, beautiful interiors. But I'm thinking from a restaurant standpoint, sometimes you walk up to a trattoria and it doesn't have a sign. You don't necessarily know where you are or what it is. How did you bring light onto that element of Italy?
Well, the formation, or what I got out of Milan at the time. And Milan is a very different part of Italy. It's a very industrial and, you know, circumspect and conservative. And, you know, it's almost Switzerland more than it is Rome. What I got out of it was the beauty of art, the sense of style, the energy of the you know, the people that are creative, the will or the desire or the ability to interpret new ideas, take them further, play around with new materials, dare to do things that in most places that I've been, there was no such enthusiasm and excitement and creativity. I think the beauty in of Italy is the fact that it's the made in Italy is not a product. It's a way of doing things. And the attitude, the class, the style that embodies all that people do is a very seductive aphrodisiac when you're a designer. You're like constantly tintillated by the possibilities. I mean, nobody says, oh, this cannot be done. First thing they say, okay, let's sit down and eat something and have a little bit of wine and then figure out what we're going to do next.
Well, it seems like you had everything you wanted, everything available to you in Italy. Why take such a romantic life and then try to open up a small studio in New York?
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that every Israeli somewhere along the line wanted to be Alfred E. Newman or Hugh Hefner.
Which one did you want to be?
Both.
Yeah.
I wanted to live in America. This was the land of opportunities. I mean, Italy for me was a place that I learned how to be a man, how to appreciate beauty and all kinds of things, but to practice it, that was not the place I wanted to practice. I wanted to practice in the United States. I wanted to make it in New York, because that's how I was brought up. I mean, if you make it here, you'll make it anywhere. So that was my dream.
What was your first architectural impression of Manhattan, of skyscrapers, of the concrete jungle?
It was wow. I will never forget the second my cab coming in from Kennedy Airport went through the tunnel and came up in Manhattan. My heart was beating. I started to sweat and I said, oh my God, this is so hot. This is so amazing. It's so powerful. And what really captured my imagination immediately was the fact that everybody was a stranger and nobody was a stranger. I was back in Israel. I mean, you know, living 5 years in Italy, you live in isolation. You live in a very xenophobic city as Milan. You know, strangers and foreigners were very, very few. City was extremely homogeneous. And even though I can pass it to as an Italian any time of the day, I still was always, oh, here is our Israeli friend. I was never one of them. The minute I got to New York, I was one of them. They were one of me. I was one of them. The buildings, the canyons, the atmosphere, the energy. I was just like completely bowled over. I said to myself, this is my last stop. I'm talking about 1974. I'm still here. You know, 40 years later, and I feel excited every day going out in the streets of Manhattan.
So I know you do a lot of hotels, but where did the restaurant aspect come in? It seems like that similar melting pot where everybody's known and unknown. It's a very similar culture to that of a restaurant.
Well, I sort of got into the restaurant design business by coincidence. And, you know, when I first came to the United States, you know, my background in Italy was very diverse. There was no work in architecture, even though I was studying architecture. There was no real work. So all the architecture firms that I apprenticed at and worked in were doing a variety of other things. We're designing furniture, we're designing interiors, we're doing exhibitions, we're doing art, graphics. So that was my formation. My design education was a factotum. I was capable of doing anything. When I came to this country, people asked me, what do I design? And I said, well, you know, give me the problem, I give you a solution. That's what I design. And he said, no. What do you do? Are you an interior designer? Are you an architect? Are you a graphic designer? Are you a furniture designer? I said, no, I do all of the above. So needless to say, I found myself starving for years because nobody was trusting me with anything in specific. They wanted me to put myself in a certain niche, to define myself, to say to the world, okay, this is Adam Tiani, is such and such. And I kept resisting it because I was Italian. You know, what am I, you know, I'm not going to, you know, give up so easily. I struggled for years and, you know, until one fateful night when somebody I think it was at 4 o'clock in the morning in Studio 54 in 1979, asked me with a French accent if I wanted to design a restaurant. I said, sure, I'll design anything. I'm like, you know, are you kidding? I got to make a living. Turned out that the project was the original La Coupole. It was the first Grand Café in New York City. Had 250 seats. Was designed to the T by yours truly, who was given free hand because the owner was sort of absent. And I had the opportunity to do architecture, interiors, I did the furniture, I did the lighting, I did the graphics, I did the uniforms. I was Italian. I was doing everything I loved to do. So when the restaurant opened, it became a huge success in 1981. Andy Warhol couldn't get in the first night, so it became even a bigger sensation. And I went out and bought a sign that said, Adam Tiani, restaurant designer. And what I just told you is really the birth of the profession. I mean, nobody was calling himself a restaurant designer, and I had no choice because I wanted to be Italian. I wanted to do everything I was doing in Italy, which I found in this microcosmos of restaurant design. Rest is history, you know. The next thing you know, somebody knocks on your door, oh, you design restaurants. I said, yes, of course, you know, that's what I do. So from one thing to the other, I sort of got stuck with that reputation and that niche.
It's a good thing to get stuck with, because from starting here in New York with La Coupole, you went on to work with people like Wolfgang Puck at Spago, other places in New York like Ciro Maccioni. You rebranded or gave a rebirth to Le Cirque. Danielle.
Several times.
Yeah. You know, Danielle Ballud, Thomas Keller's Per Se, and Bouchon. We're going to take a quick break, but we're not just going to be city-centric. We're going to travel the globe a little bit and talk about Cape Town, South Africa, about Beverly Hills, and so much more. You've been listening to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hey, and welcome back to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan-Jerkel, here again today with Adam D. Tahani, a restaurant designer. You can actually say that now because it's printed on your business card. But you were also a restaurant tour, a restaurant owner.
Oh, yes.
With Remy Group for, 25 years?
That's correct.
How did you get brought into that?
Well, you know, again, like everything else in my life, it's all coincidences, you know, that you can't say no. I designed a couple of restaurants for a gentleman by the name of Dino De Laurentiis, the famous Italian movie producer. And one of the spaces that I designed for him was something called DDL Food Show on the Upper West Side. It was at the, an 81st in Columbus. You know, when that opened, it was still sort of a no man land. You know, you were risking your life to go up there. But that was an early version of Italy, way ahead of its time, when nobody understood what it means to go up to a bar and order an espresso and drink it standing up. I mean, there was nothing like that in New York. What happened in that space is that I met a gentleman who was actually turning chickens in a rotisserie. It was a young Italian chef from Venice who was brought in by Dino. His name was Francesco Antonucci, and we struck a friendship, and we've been friends, going out to dinner. He was cooking in my house and so on, so for years. And one day he says to me, "You know, Adam, I think I'm ready to open my own restaurant. Would you help me design it?" I said, "Sure, of course, you know, you're like my brother." So from one thing to next, we found a space, and the investment wasn't that big. And, you know, I said, "Okay, you know what? We'll bring in one more partner. You, me, and him will open the restaurant." And next thing I know, I find myself in the front of this dining room on 79th Street between 1st and 2nd. Greeting people and playing maitre d', because Francesco was busy, and we had a 500 square foot kitchen, and he was so nervous that he even developed a stutter and he couldn't even talk to anybody. So somebody had to do it. And so for 3 years, I would finish what I do in my studio at 6 in the evening, go uptown and open the restaurant with Francesco and close it at midnight. This was back in 86. And believe it or not, there's still people on the Upper East Side when they see me and say, "Oh, Mr. Remy, how are you doing? You have left the neighborhood." They have no clue of who I am and what I do. For them, I'm still the restaurateur Adam Tahani, which was quite a bit of an experience.
Did you feel like a maitre d' at some of the other restaurants you designed?
I mean, all the time. I'm in every restaurant I walk in, I feel like a maitre d' wanting to fix things and stuff. but I have to tell you, Michael, the great thing that came out of this, besides the fact that I used to work for 22 hours a day, it killed my marriage and whatnot. But the great thing that came out of it is that people started seeing me as a restaurateur. I absorbed all the punishments that I usually inflict on my clients on myself. I learned the hard way of what is a service station, of the correlation between the front and the back of the house, of the fact that if the two of them don't work in synergy, you can't create a good restaurant. So, you know, when I talk today with my clients, friends, chefs, such as Thomas or Daniel Bolu or Jean-Georges, I mean, they all of them used to eat in my restaurant. They knew me as a restaurateur as well as a designer. So they see me as a colleague, and the conversation is so much easier. I mean, because we get to focus on what really is important. I mean, they don't have to tell me how many service stations you need for 80 seats and where they should be located. I know that. Every single person in my office used to have to work in the restaurant, you know, in any capacity every couple of months just to get the experience of what it means to actually practice what you preach. So it was an invaluable experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's very New York-centric. You know, sometimes when you apply for a job here, it says must have New York experience, which is a weird catch-22 because how can you have New York experience without ever being in New York before? But You've traveled the world, too. I mean, you've done projects in South Africa, in the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, mm-hmm. in Beverly Hills, the Jewel in Dallas. Mm-hmm. What has those projects, designed in places other than New York, you know, informed you of bringing back to New York and changing service here?
Well, I think it's actually maybe the other way around. I mean, you know, all of the projects that you mentioned and many more are very site-specific. I mean, we are extremely proud of the fact that we go to huge lengths to try to learn or understand the DNA of every place we work at and try to express that in design. You know, when we go to Cape Town, we portray Cape Town not as a local would see it, but as a visitor, you know, because we're designing hotels for visitors, not for locals. So it's important that you understand where you come from to know where you're going to. And you would be surprised to know that all of the world really looks up to New York. They look up to us. They say, oh, you come from New York. Well, you must know something that we don't know. I mean, this is the center of creativity. This is the center of ideas. We're so glad to be able to cooperate and collaborate with somebody that brings that type of knowledge to us. Now, maybe I misspoke by saying everybody wants to be in New York, but they certainly look up for inspiration and for, you know, ideas to us. And when you travel, when I go to Seoul, Korea, for example, to design Westin Chusan Hotel, they said, well, we want a great Korean steakhouse, but with a little bit of New York attitude. Who else, who better than you to do this? Because you know what a New York steakhouse is, and we have great steaks in Korea, but we just want to add that little oomph. I said, really, you're going to, you know, hire Jewish waiters with attitude? Is that what you mean? He said, no, but you know what I'm saying. So they really value the international perspective, and they are very excited about having somebody coming from New York or Brooklyn, for that matter, with that perspective.
You know, I find Thomas Keller an interesting case because you had worked with him in the past, and then Per Se was here in New York. But you so importantly said that, you know, you're trying to show a vision. in a sense, paint a portrait of a person's food in a personal space. How did you do that with Per Se without compromising everything that Thomas Keller had done before?
Well, you know, first you have to know that Thomas Keller was my student. That's how I met him. I was teaching restaurant design at School of Visual Arts, and Thomas was moonlighting in my courses. And he was clearly the older person in the room. And one day I went to him and said, you know, what are you doing here? He says, well, I'm you know, I want to know everything there is to know about restaurant design. I said, why? He says, well, because, you know, one day when I build my own restaurant, I want to be knowledgeable. Said, that's admirable. So I introduced myself and said, I'm Adam Tiani. He says, I'm Thomas Keller. And we became friends. And we've known each other for many, many years until before he came to me with the first Bouchon. Now, to answer your question, how do you translate a highly, you know, personal, residential-looking, let's say, inspirational restaurant from Napa Valley, beautiful little building with history, into fourth floor, steel and concrete and glass building in Manhattan without losing a beat? That was the challenge, right? Well, you know, it's about perception. It's not about reality. You have to start with the conviction that all we're doing is basically packaging a perception, because most people's never been to the French Laundry. The ones that have been will never compare it to the one in New York to begin with, because it's impossible. So how people in this city conceive a brand of hospitality led by Thomas Keller, with his backlog of reputation and so on and so forth? And incidentally, he had quite a bit of experience in New York, if you recall. Mm-hmm. So again, it was about packaging a brand of hospitality and a perception. And if you go with that, you have to go through an interesting process, which I can't actually walk your listeners through, because, you know, people pay me a lot of money to do this, and I don't want to give it out. But it's a process of how you have to imagine what people would think, or what would they expect the brand of hospitality to be.
I mean, it really all started at the door with Per Se.
Correct.
There's an allusion to the French Laundry simply by the materials and colors that you chose.
Correct, but the door doesn't open. The two side panels slide open. So there is a little bit a nod to Thomas as a very humorous and funny guy, which most people don't think he is, but he actually is. I mean, if you consider some of his famous dishes and their names, like, you know, oysters and pearls and all that, it's so humorous that it's not even funny, as they say.
Yeah.
But we had it, to me, it's a portrait of a great artist in an unfamiliar territory here, and we had to create this custom outfit for him that is credible, that has to do with an incredible sense of style and detail and solid gravitas, you know. So, you know, I think it went well.
I think it's going well.
Yeah,
from what I've heard. You know, to a lesser degree, you know, not your own restaurants, but any old restaurant. Let's use here Roberta's as an example. I know most chefs walk into a restaurant and critique the food that's on their plate. As a designer, what are the first things that you see when you walk through a door of a restaurant?
I think I have a very trained eye to absorb a lot of details. But most people, what I'm concerned about is not what I see. What I'm concerned about is what a normal person would see, because that's our customer. People have difficulties absorbing a lot. They can absorb one or two things very well. But a lot is quite difficult. It takes time and training. So the first impression that captures your imagination and tells you a little bit about what the experience is going to be has to do with two things. It has to do with light and with the smell, sense of smell. And that is not necessarily both, not necessarily design. I mean, the light and smell give you the feeling of comfort. And the third thing is really is the noise level. So those are three senses that dictate immediately in your subconscious what kind of experience are you going to have. And the second layer has to do with colors and materials. And, you know, I mean, if you walk into a restaurant that you've never been before, you just look inside, you see a beautiful flower arrangement, gorgeous chandeliers, a very elegant hostess with a great smile and a nice dress, you wouldn't expect to have a hamburger on your table, if you know what I mean. All of these things dictate, you know, a preconceived experience, because we relate to our senses, to our memory, and to our memory of smell more than to anything else. It's an instinct almost.
So, I mean, there must also be cultural, you know, things within a cuisine that also inform, you know, what you want to see and what you want to smell at a restaurant.
Of course.
So, of some of those examples that you've designed around the world, how does the food pair with the functional design?
The food is the main actor in the play. It's the main act. A good restaurant consists of three pillars of you know, let's say service, food, and atmosphere, which translates to design. Best restaurants usually have a very nice balance between these three. But in many instances, restaurants are heavy on service and food, and they're, you know, light on the atmosphere. Some of them are very heavy on atmosphere. The food and the service are lacking. Some of them lack everything. Some of them have everything. But in different times, any one of these pillars assumes a different weight, because the first impression that you have, if you don't know anything about the food, and obviously you don't know anything about the service because you've never eaten there, what will capture your imagination is the atmosphere, is the look, is the feel. Once you pass that, if the food is not good and the service is not good, it probably won't come back. I mean, take, for example, Roberta's. Your first impression, if you walk into this place, you know nothing about it, it says, oh my God, you know, what's going on here? but then suddenly everything starts to fall into place, because it's all cohesive. I mean, everything is relating to the next. The food here is exactly what you expect it to be here. You know, but it takes time for you to gel all these different, you know, feelings and smells and sights, and drawing conclusion that this is really a place that works.
I want to ask a question. This may be a sad topic, because I know what just recently happened. Your favorite, I've asked you this before, your favorite seat in any restaurant in the world was a standing reservation every Tuesday at 8 p.m. at 15 East. How many years have you been going there?
Since Maso has been this, 9 years.
What was it like to sit in that seat? What kind of restaurant experience in totality was that?
Well, I think that what's most important to me is consistency. It's the fact that I can come every week, sit in the same seat, and have the same experience. Now, you would think that for some people this is crazy. You know, they want every day another experience. Why would they? To me, the nuances of the experience are what matters. I mean, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have seen the Gary's Sense of Sushi movie, where the master chef talks about 20 years of perfecting, you know, one piece of sushi. To me, when it comes to sushi, this is how I am. I mean, I'm ordering the same piece of fish every week on the same seat, most of the time at the same time, and I'm learning how it grows from one experience to the next. And they're very micro differences, but differences nevertheless. The differences have to do a lot with me, my mood, and how do I feel at that time, and not necessarily the actual sushi would have been absolutely perfect, but every week when the fish is flown in from Japan, it's a little bit different. It's not the same piece of fish. So to me, the consistency of the experience was what mattered.
So what are tahini constants? What do you see in every one of your spaces?
First of all, I think comfort. I am particularly sticky to making sure that the chairs are comfortable, the banquettes are comfortable. You can sit there for hours or minutes, doesn't matter. It's a sense of well-being. I think the second element that adds to discomfort is the lighting. To me, everybody has to look fantastic and feel fantastic, you know. Long time ago, I designed nightclubs, and one of my clients was this amazing Brazilian entrepreneur, said to me, when women look good, men spend money. Make sure you don't screw up the lighting. And he was 100% right. You know, when people look good, they feel good. So to me, the lighting and the comfort are a hallmark of what I do.
And now you have this whole other, you know, project, which is a sea, you know, Seabourn, these ultra luxe cruise liners. I mean, they're open air in a sense. You get to play with all the light that you want.
They're open air during the day, but at nighttime, you know, it's black all around you. You know, you have to create your own atmosphere. I mean, you know, the success of good lighting, no matter whether you're at sea or in the air, or is control. It's a very simple thing. It's called dimmer. If you can control the lighting, you control the mood of the people. I mean, you do a very stupid experiment. You just sit in a room full of light and you dim the light, people start to whisper. Why? Why? What happened? Oh, why? You can't speak in a high voice when it's dark?
That's ingrained in us during kindergarten.
Yeah, but that's what I'm talking about. That's not the only thing ingrained in you. There's a lot of things that are ingrained in you that you don't know of. And if I, as a designer, is now not smart enough to take advantage, how can I control your experience?
See, I thought all this time all I cared about was hooks at bars. You know, when you look under there and there wasn't that hook to put a bag or a jacket, that was a complete design fail. But I know there are so many more elements.
I didn't know that you walk around with handbags, my friend. Yeah, very nice.
It's a man purse, you know. if your book wasn't so darn big, then I would probably carry it around underneath my arms. But I want to say thank you, and I want to say that everyone should go out and get this wonderful tome of a book. It's Tahani, Iconic Hotel and Restaurant Interiors by Rizzoli, because there are these stories and so, so, so much more. And I can't wait to walk into my next Tahani Design restaurant. And I'm going to check for hooks this time, though. I'm going to make sure
we do put hooks, but in the bathroom.
Excellent. Well, I won't spend too much time there.
You want to take your jacket when you're on the toilet.
Yeah.
There you have it.
At least I know the lighting's going to be great. Well, I just wanted to thank our sponsor, Edwards VA Ham, Jack and Maggie for being in the studio, Cookies, as always, for the wonderful theme and break music. And, you know, check us out on iTunes, download the podcast, and we'd love to hear from our listeners, rate and review us. And next up is a little clip from Justin Warner on Cherry Bear's show talking about the laws of food. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
We determined that people want to know why and how of food. Not so much just instruction recipes. They want to get something and learn something.
On episode 61 of All in the Industry, Justin Warner joins host Cherry Bear to explain the secret principles behind his offbeat culinary creations.
And so they said, you know, foie gras donut, for example. I mean, why on earth did you make that? I said, well, I mean, it's a long story, but I knew it would go together. I mean, it's kind of like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And they're like, wait a minute, peanut butter? You're telling me that a foie gras donut is a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? I said, yeah, I mean, so is pizza. They're like, what? Like, yeah, of course. Like, it's about fruit and fat and having some canvas to spread it on. I mean, the foie gras is fat, peanut butter is fat, cheese is fat. Tomatoes of fruit, jellies of fruit, PB&J, you know, foie gras donut, it's all there, pizza. So I determined that the law of peanut butter and jelly is something that is true and something that exists and it is real. And if you have fruit, fat, canvas, you'll be fine. Yeah, so like another law is the coffee, cream, and sugar law, which is kind of the idea if you have something bitter, add something creamy, add something sweet. Or you could just say fatty and sweet. So, I mean, if you think about coffee or raw chocolate, you know, cacao is bitter as all get out. It's one of the bitterest things that there is. But the second you add sugar and milk to it, it becomes milk chocolate. So that's kind of, you know, just a simple example. But, you know, if you look at, like, bitter greens, most of the time people add some sort of oily, fatty component and something that's subtly sweet to it. I mean, that's what makes great greens.
To hear more from Justin Warner and special guest photographer Daniel Krieger, check out episode 61 of All in the Industry with Cherry Bear. For more great shows on the hospitality industry, you can listen to all the episodes of All in the Industry available on heritageradionetwork.org. This piece was brought to you by Fairway Market. Like no other market, fairwaymarket.com.